This program is brought to you by PersonalLifeMedia.com. Welcome to Dishy Mix. I'm your host, Susan Bratton. Hey, it's great to have you on the show today. Thank you so much for listening. I have my favorite all-time interview person, David Karlick, David Scott Karlick, the managing partner, managing director of Vantage Point Venture Partners, on the show again today. We did a show back when I was still distributed by Webmaster Radio, and God, it was the most fun show I've ever had doing a Dishy Mix. David and I talked about everything from the race riots of the 60s to waterbed sex to creationists and why he takes his signature look from Ivan Boesky. We had conversations that ranged from mood rings to Australian Shiraz, and it was a super fun time. I couldn't wait a year to have him back on. That was in March, the March 15th episode of Dishy Mix. So you get David Karlick again today. He's a hippie woodworker turned millionaire VC, and he is super fun to talk to. On today's show, we're going to talk about everything from his opinion on the taxation laws to some guilty pleasures, the oil crisis, what he's done to secure a future for widows and orphans, social networking, of course, because what would Dishy Mix be without some sort of conversation about social networking, voyeurism and exhibitionism, which I know you'll like, some of the bad decisions he's made. I'm going to get some marriage advice from Dave, and we'll talk about some of his horrible investing decisions. So we're going to get the good, the bad, the ugly, and the most fun with David Karlick.
There is that, but you know, all things considered, we are healthy, happy, have great choices, have a vibrant economy, have jobs, houses, for better or for worse, are twice the size they were. We have more stuff. We have better education. We have, you know, a very exciting world to live in. I can't imagine life not working and being able to be associated with the kind of entrepreneurs that I get to work with. They talk about the new generation being spoiled or slackers, but you don't see that in the guys that are going out starting companies or going to work for startups. Social networking generally means that it's a way for people to communicate to one another, and it's user-generated content. You know, we don't have editors create it, and it has a viral nature of growth. So those are the three defining elements of social networking. One of the things that's the most fun about online direct marketing is, and unfortunately it's not taken advantage of enough, is that people respond to kits. People respond to stuff that, you know, that's fun.
Welcome, David.
Hey, thank you.
How's my hippie woodworker?
You know, if I could have become a millionaire hippie woodworker, we could have skipped all the intervening bad investment decisions, failed marriages, and widows and orphans.
But life is a journey, and you must walk the path, right?
I suppose so. So I was fascinated to have my nephew, who's 20 years old, in school, studying computer graphics, looking to be one of the laborers at Pixar and heading towards that way very nicely, called me up one day completely alarmed by the future of the world. And I thought, oh my Lord, you know, this is great. I've got to find for him. I got to go on eBay and find the old Whole Earth catalog.
Right.
And show him that, you know, this is some sort of a generational issue, but that it's been thought of before, but that doesn't mean it's been solved.
That's exactly right. It takes every new generation to try to solve those problems, doesn't it?
I suppose so. You know, it's interesting to reflect on what the boomers have accomplished from the Woodstock era and the just say no to the Vietnam War all the way through to where we are now, which is somehow we managed to get ourselves into another messier, more expensive, even worser war. We've managed to go from being, you know, people who are thrifty to being a oil-guzzling, gas-guzzling, energy-consuming behemoth, and we've managed to paint ourselves into a deficit where we're handing over to the next generation some real headaches. So what the heck happened? You have to tell me.
You know, those are problems that we've definitely created. I like to think it's, you know, people older than I, but I have definitely been a party to the consumptive behemoth that is the boomer generation. What have we done good? What have we done as boomers that's good? Well, the sexual revolution. I think we've done a good job with that.
Yeah.
Many of us, anyway.
Yeah.
What else?
As the joke goes, we invented the internet.
That's right. We did that. Yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah, that was a good one.
Anything else?
All the things that went along with it.
I would say probably the natural and organic food movement. At least we started that, right?
Yeah.
Not to say that 98% of the food we eat now has corn syrup and soybean somehow injected into it in some chemical breakdown.
There is that. But, mm-hmm. You know, all things considered, we are healthy, happy, have great choices, have a vibrant economy, have jobs, houses, for better or for worse, are twice the size they were. We have more stuff. We have better education. We have, you know, a very exciting world to live in. And you know, not to plug us too much or plug the business that I'm in, but I'm seeing a very aggressive side of clean tech investing. You know, it's almost like Ayn Rand, where greed is good. Mm-hmm. I've always felt that way.
Mm-hmm.
Ayn Rand is back in style again.
Isn't she? I know, I've been hearing about her all over the place lately. It's the funniest thing.
Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of money going out to create electric cars and new energy generation and so forth, and actually, you know, to even bypass the ethanol fad that looks like another one of those lobby things from the farm group that isn't in the interest of the world at large.
Well, you, at Vantage Point, so you've been investing in online marketing companies since the mid-90s, and you joined the Vantage Point team in 97, so that's 10 years.
98 was when I officially joined.
98, okay.
So it'll be 10 years in 2008, in 3 months, roughly.
In 3 months. Now, in those, let's just call it 10 years. I think we're safe to do that. We can round up a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
In the last 10 years, how much money have you been involved in moving from your limited partners to companies that you've helped get going?
I was just doing that tally, Susan, and it's interesting. I have been on the originating deal team and gone on the board of the investments as a contingent of the investment. So that's what I view as my direct connection.
Mm-hmm.
To now just past $200 million, which is a number that I would have never dreamed when I came in here earlier.
And what kind of payback will your investors see? What do you estimate that you're going to go out and give away $200 million, invest it wisely, and make your bets
right
with $200 million of OPM, right, other people's money?
Mm-hmm.
What do you promise to give back to them? What do they expect?
Well, it's on the books now, either returned or at conservative valuations at 2.5 times that.
Mm-hmm.
So
$500 million.
You know, slightly under that number.
Mm-hmm.
But there are still a few companies that may or may not survive, and there's still a few of those companies that will probably have a substantial uptick. So I'm hoping to see our LPs get back from those investments in the aggregate 3 to 5 times their money. And I joke about being widows and orphans, but of course our limited partners are typically, you know, large pensions, endowments, so forth.
Yeah, but you've also created a lot of jobs.
That's the part that
you know, like the best,
the
right?
Hippie woodworker, yeah.
Yeah, the hippie woodworker likes the job creation and more consumption.
Actually, when I reflect on the business and my life in it, it's an odd one because I'm in this for 10 years out of my now 40 years of working. So 1/4 of my career has been in this investing area, and there's parts of it that are blunt and brutal and cold-hearted,
mm-hmm.
and that part is hard for me.
It is hard for you, I know.
And but, you know, in the end, you do wind up helping to create companies that make a difference and helping to those companies create jobs and helping those companies and jobs return the capital and more to the literally retirement funds that have put the money at our trust. So it's a good cycle. It's a crucible. There's a lot of spotlight on you, and even though now I'm theoretically playing with house money, it doesn't make it any more relaxed.
Mm-hmm. And how long do you think you'll keep doing it? I mean, you have to have enough now after your MySpace fabulous sale.
Well, you mean me personally?
Yeah.
My participation in the Vantage Point success is in the overall success of the fund. I'm not tied to any particular company.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
But I've done well over the years. I could quit.
Yeah.
But you know, Susan, I can't imagine life not working and being able to be associated with the kind of entrepreneurs that I get to work with.
Right.
Talk about the new generation being spoiled or slackers, but you don't see that in the guys that are going out starting companies or going to work for startups.
And is it only guys?
For some reason, I seem to have, on the founding teams, mostly guys. Mm-hmm. In my particular ones, we have women who've led investments in other investments here, and a lot of our Vantage Point, three of our top investing professionals, the group leaders are women. But I say guys partly, Susan, because I come from the media world. And in the media world, guys was representative of both sexes. We're all guys.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't use guys and gals. We're all guys. And so I use guys as a non-gender-specific deal.
Got it.
And so the people who were at the startups are so exciting. So, you know, could you imagine just, you know, hanging around with the old farts at the country club and complaining that we haven't sent enough troops to Iraq? I can't quite get there. Compared to seeing folks do things like start MySpace from scratch and turn it into something, or seeing folks like Reach Local transform, you know, how small businesses get to grow their business online and get thank you letters from small businesses that say, oh my God, I was just scraping along, I was about to go out of business, and then you guys started doing my online marketing, and I've hired three people and opened a new office. That's just exciting stuff.
That is. And that Reach Local is one of your current investments in board seats. You're also on the board of Three Guppies, AllBusiness.com,
yeah.
Daytran Media, Grocery Shopping Network, Healthline, and Zvents. So,
and Multiply.
Multiply, that's a new one?
Yes.
Okay, so what's Multiply? Tell us about that.
Multiply is very cool. It's it falls under the rubric of social networking in that it's a way that people can communicate amongst one another, or between one another, amongst themselves, among each other. I'm grammatically failing. My English degree is wearing off. Well, I didn't actually get an English degree. I got an accounting degree. So
it just is because you're being interviewed.
That's it.
It's just pressure.
It's just the tension.
I don't actually know what the answer is either, and I'm not being interviewed.
So social networking generally means that it's a way for people to communicate to one another, and it's user-generated content. You know, we don't have editors create it, and it has a viral nature of growth. So those are the three defining elements of social networking. But it can have many different applications. So Multiply is a way that, you know, families and friends or groups can communicate and share the images and digital stuff that is part of their lives. So in a sense, it's a way a family can build a website about their family. Pictures of the kids, share it with the grandparents, share it with their friends. Their friends and grandparents can comment on it and can share it and you know, add their own images and so forth, and it creates this living scrapbook which we store for life, if you want,
mm-hmm.
and preserve. So in 20 years, when you want to look back on the days of Junior first crawling across the rug and eating the banana slug, it'll be there for you, along with the comments and the family thoughts and the bits and pieces and the conversations that went with it. So that kind of it is a social networking application, but it has a different purpose, let's say, than publishing yourself on MySpace to be found, or, you know, networking with folks like you might do on Facebook.
Yeah, the iFame. You, as a matter of fact, you were talking about something around social networking that you think one of the powerful things about social networking is both voyeurism and exhibitionism. Tell us about that.
It's true. It's true. I think they used to say in academics it was publish or perish.
Yeah.
Now I wonder if in real life You must have yourself up somewhere. Have you read the little bit of there's people who specialize in helping you develop a baby name that will show up as a unique on the search engines?
No.
So you can pay extra for that. So you could have Obama bin Laden Bratton.
I think not. I was thinking about all the great African American names that are kind of mashup, unique mashup names. That if you want to find a unique name, you should definitely work into the African American community. Chautauqua was only the beginning, you know?
It's like being unique, and once you're unique once, until somebody else sees it, it's unique, and then they can use it as well.
Right.
We'll see how that works. Now, fortunately, there's only a couple Carlicks. I gave up Carlick.com years ago because I thought I was the only one. But it turns out there's a Carlick Lithographers in New York who took over Carlick.com, and they have it. So I can't have Carlick.com back again. But when you do a Google or a search or ask, search for Carlick or David Carlick, I show up because it is a unique name.
It is, and it's a beautiful name. It's easy to spell. I mean, you have a great name.
You know, it was not an easy name to have as a kid.
Huh, why?
Well, it was Garlic or Carlick or something. It was
right. There's all the licky stuff.
Yeah. You know? And one time we published an ad for Carlick Advertising, and nobody knew the name. So I had a big picture of a car. And then from the side of the car, a female mouth, you know, grossly disproportionate, so you could just see the red lips and the tongue sticking out. And the tongue was licking the side mirror of the car. And the ad was something about car and lick, so you could remember our name.
You've never been above absolute kitsch.
I one of the things that's the most fun about online direct marketing is, and unfortunately, it's not taken advantage of enough, is that people respond to kitsch. People respond to stuff that, you know...
Fun!
That's fun.
So yeah.
I saw a presentation that was one of my favorites. It was at an ad show by some folks who were about the Taguchi Now method. Ex-journalist.
Really well done.
Mm-hmm. And so what he showed was the ad that tested best online for weight loss. It wasn't aspirational. It wasn't... you know, a competitive thing. It was a big picture of looking into the gaping jaws of a bulldozer, right? So you're looking head-on at the bulldozer, and the bulldozer is dumping a load, and that load is falling down below the frame, so you can only see part of the load that the thing is dumped out. But the load is dumped out as a fat woman falling down, and then standing to the side of the bulldozer in a hard hat is a secretary in a miniskirt and high heels and her boss, holding a clipboard and laughing at the, and so obviously it's aimed at women who are getting heavy and their husbands at work with a pretty secretary and they're overweight and they're going to get dumped. And you would think that this is probably the worst possible way that you could possibly try to talk somebody into signing up and paying you money for a weight loss program. It's blunt, it's mean-spirited, and so forth, although it was very funny. And the beauty of the online direct marketing part of it is that they could just fan it out in a test to some folks, and if it didn't work, then they would quit using it. But it worked very well, so off to the races. And I don't think there's a creative aesthetic in the world that would have viewed that as being the way to get customers, but the customers flocked to it.
Well, I would like to see that picture. I don't know if it's anything that we can put on my blog, but if we can, let's get a copy of it and put it on dishymix.com, because I think people would like to see how affronting something that works really well can be. We try to be quite delicate in marketing, but it could be to our disadvantage, right?
I think marketing, of course, is where people go who want to make the world a little prettier.
Yeah, could be. It could be. Hey, we're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about your idea of tax law, some of your guilty pleasures, and perhaps the oil crisis. So stay tuned. This is your host, Susan Bratton. We're with David Scott Carlick, the one and only Carlick in our lives, and we'll be right back.
Listen to Living Green, Effortless Ecology for Everyday People, a weekly online audio program featuring champions of sustainable living at personallifemedia.com.
Okay, we're back, and we have David Carlick on the line today. And David, one of the questions that I asked you was, if you could change the one thing about the business world, what would it be? And your answer was your opinion about taxes. Tell us that story.
Well, again, I was taken by surprise by my nephew's worries about the world, and among his worries were that we're using up energy. Not so much the Al Gore global warming, although certainly having the oceans rise a few feet would wreak havoc with most of the civilized world, but also with the economic effects of what gets passed along to the next generation. Because if we do not have an infrastructure to replace our current infrastructure and energy gets too expensive, then there's dire consequences. And those consequences will show up in 30 or 40 years, which to a 20-year-old is grim and to a person my age is less so. And I was excited to see him, looking at this and wanting to take action. And he asked me, well, what can I do? And I thought about it, and I thought, really, one of the things that could be gotten behind, one of the causes that could be advanced would be a change in the tax system. Now, why do I say a change in the tax system? Is because tax has two functions in life. One function is to raise money to run the government's operations. And the other one is to change human behavior,
right?
As an incentive for different economic behavior. So an example is we have a deduction for your property tax and the interest on owning a home, and we've had also exemptions for some of the selling price of a house, so that you can buy a bigger house or move up without having to be taxed on the whole thing. So we have given a tax incentive for people to become homeowners. And, of course, there's now the tax code, which is huge, has a whole lot of different deductions and exemptions and so forth. And all those really are there is by somebody who wants taxes to change behavior. What we've created is a tax system that's so big and so expensive that you have to pay money to have your tax return filled out, and it's complicated and huge time waste, in my opinion. It probably eats up 3 or 4% of the gross national product just figuring out which deductions to use, plus we're not incentivizing the right things. And as I looked at my nephew's concerns, I thought, what if we could just take away all of the myriad tax codes, streamline the whole thing like Malcolm Forbes has been talking about doing with a flat tax. But instead of a flat tax on income, what if you instead had a flat tax on consumption, sort of a giant sales tax?
The more you consume, the more you pay.
The more you consume, the more you pay. Obviously, it takes a lot of the worry about illegal immigrants out who aren't taxed necessarily because they're paid in a cash economy because they have to buy stuff, and when they buy stuff, they get caught up in the tax system. The levers would be like Ben Bernanke and his levers on the interest rates, which would be that how much you tax would determine, how expensive it is to do different things. I thought, boy, simplify the tax system, make it a tax on what you buy, and I bet behavior would change. Then the second thing I would do to add on to that, or suggest for him to do, since it's going to take some work, would be to put a surtax on energy, surtax on gasoline, surtax on electricity, surtax on those things that are finite for us, and direct that surtax, the proceeds from that, towards building the kind of infrastructure that we'll need to survive in, let's call it, $400 a barrel of oil, so that we have some modicum of terrain, so we have incentives, and so people have enough warning. Now, if you were to say, tell the world that there's going to be a dollar a gallon tax per year higher on gasoline, it would enable people to plan their purchases, and in the end, drive the industry towards 100 miles per gallon cars, which would have the same fuel bill as today's 25-mile-per-gallon car has at the current tax rate. And it would also enable those taxes to raise a lot of money to build some of the things we need to be able to have people give up, say, cars, or to move to more energy-efficient living and so forth. So that was my thought. It may be completely stupid. Economists may denounce it, but I think that simplifying the tax system and steering people away from consumption would have a huge effect. It would subtly drive things. If you were taxed on the cost of goods, then would manufacturers, put so much cost into the goods, so much shrink wrap, so much packaging, so much wasted material, so many yards of paper to get a cheeseburger out of the place. So it just goes on and on and on. So that's what I'm thinking. I think it's the kind of initiative where rather than try to scald 1,000 little behaviors with 1,000 little tax rules,
yeah,
you just have one big tax rule that Your income is free, but when you buy something, you pay the piper.
Maybe it's your time to go into politics.
I'd like to go into politics, except that I can't bear two things about it. One of it is that the government of the United States is not only run by lawyers, everybody in the legislature and the House is largely a lawyer, but all the people who work for them and make all the decisions and recommendations are lawyers. And all that lawyering is ultimately going to lead to the decline of our civilization. It should be run by engineers, but we're not doing that. And I don't function well in a world that's completely full of lawyers who are working the language of everything. And the second is that my personal life and past couldn't stand even 10 seconds of the scrutiny that a politician gets.
That's what I like about you. I love that sordid past of yours.
I've had the Carlick variation of the wide stance in so many different varieties over the course of my years that I can't stand to have it relived in the public glare. So, nope, not a chance.
Well, one of the other things that I'd asked you about was what book you were reading that you were recommending to your friends right now. And you came up with something very unique. Tell us about that.
Well, I've been recommending The Reckoning by David Halberstam. Halberstam, of course, was recently killed in an accident in Palo Alto when he was visiting Stanford.
Oh my God, I didn't know that. How did he get killed?
Funny, he got a Stanford grad student to drive him to some meeting across the East Bay in the grad student's Toyota Camry. And they were heading out to the Dumbarton Bridge in that intersection down there by Sun Microsystems. And the kid apparently got distracted by being with the great Halberstam and missed a light, got sideswiped, and Halberstam was killed.
Oh, my God. And is the kid still living?
Yeah, I don't remember.
Wow.
It's funny how you absorb and remember things.
Right.
So Halberstam wrote a book called The Reckoning, and that was written maybe 25 years ago. I don't remember the exact date. It's out of print. I went to get it on Amazon, and you have to actually buy it used. And The Reckoning was a history of the automotive industry. So it goes back to the origins of Ford Motor Company as its main story feature and to the origins of Nissan, covering also at the same time General Motors and Toyota. But it came at it, it came at the thing opening up in as the oil crisis was about to hit in 1970 or thereabouts. And some folks called on the car makers and pointed out that their cars were all wrong for the coming market, that gas was going to get expensive, big cars would put them in the tank, and they would be a disaster. And the GM and Ford said, nope, that's not what people want. Our profitable cars are our big cars. Small cars don't matter. And so they completely missed the market. The fuel crisis came. The oil embargo came. The oil prices went up. People dropped their big cars like a hot rock. It's one of the reasons that I became interested in this taxation deal is that if you go back to the early 70s when we had the first oil crisis in fuel lines, people couldn't sell their big Oldsmobiles fast enough to buy little Toyotas and Nissans, then Datsuns. So the American car companies just got creamed by this, and it gave birth to the Japanese car companies, and the story of their birth is a great story of capitalism, and the story of Nissan's journey into America.
Wasn't it Datsun, remember?
It was Datsun.
Datsun.
Datsun had a guy named Mr. Katayama. I may mispronounce it. Kayatama Katayama. I'm a member of MAD, which is, or actually a member of DAM. Sorry, DAM, which is Mothers Against Dyslexia. and I have all kinds of trouble with names. But he was Mr. K, and he was memorialized in Chiat Day's advertising for Nissan, having the original Datsun guy, who was this Japanese salesman, showboat guy who came over to America and went like door to door. And in L.A., when I used to live, where the Japanese cars came in, he started by selling pickup trucks to the Japanese gardeners.
And they still use those little Toyota pickup trucks.
Yeah, although there's no Japanese gardeners left that I can think of. They've all become doctors or business people or executives. So the gardening business has changed. But in the late 60s and early 70s, at least in L.A., the Japanese who had come here dominated the small business sector of being gardeners, and they bought those rugged little trucks that were just so helpful and useful and got the business off to a start. So the funny part of it, Susan, about the book is that not only did this book document the absolute, rise of the new Japanese, which had, this is like post-war Japan, still recovering, still barely able to mount up a factory, but with smaller, more fuel-effective cars, able to create you know, large companies that now dominate the industry, Toyota's heading towards being the largest, all on the opening left by the American guys who refused to see that oil was going to be a problem. So aside from being a rich history of the auto business of the people in it and Henry Ford and his whole story, it's unbelievable that here we are with a fleet of huge SUVs getting creamed by a bunch of fuel-efficient hybrid cars and $89 per barrel oil and people just not wanting to do that, that the American industry could repeat something that was actually documented as fully as it was in the 70s, 30-some years ago. How does history repeat itself?
We learn absolutely nothing from history. That being said, I want you to tell us about the worst mistake you ever made. You told me the worst fork in the road bad decision that you regret was the sale of your agency before agencies got popular. What I don't want you to tell me that story. What I want you to tell me is what advice would you give us for not making mistakes that you made?
You know, my mistakes have been timing, not the actual act, and I don't think that you can necessarily change your timing. I'm not that good of a student of things. I'm not that analytical. I tend to act on what's in front of me. There are analytical people who are better. So I did sell my agency at a time when they were cheap, and then the interactive world started, and what my agency would have been worth many times more than I sold it for. But on the other hand, I went to work at Bozell and Poppy Tyson and got to work in an environment that I might otherwise never have seen and got to do some things I might otherwise not have done. So I'm going to be happy about it, but the timing was such that I'm at least, you know, in hindsight, possibly economically poor. And, of course, then I came into venture capital and spun up right into the year 2000.
Right, dot-com.
So I went $28 million in the hole before I crawled back out again several years later. It was another piece of bad timing. Why didn't I start sooner or start later? But I can't change it, and now it's all worked out pretty well. I left the DoubleQuick, you know, early on before it went on to its most stellar stages, and the same with Poppy.com. And that was probably ill timing. I probably could have had much more fun and excitement doing the things that we were doing there. So those are my regrets. But then on the other hand, I was there at the birth of the two and got to see them get started, and been through a few. I have had a good seat in the stands at this entire industry. It's been very exciting.
Absolutely, and clearly you netted out at the end ahead.
Little nets along the way, right?
Yeah.
Hits here, a little hit there, a little hit here, a little hit there, and pretty soon you have a little hit. The thing about Silicon Valley is it's like a big theme park, right? And so there's all these rides, and everybody goes and gets in line for a ride. One of the rides might be Google. One of the rides might be, some company you've never heard of again.
VMware.
Well, yeah, like VMware. And so you don't know when you get on that ride. And then you look at some of the people come out of the exit of the ride on giant ocean liners that they own, and other people come out in tatters, floating and drowning and trying to climb up and get on another ride, or I'll skip this park. I'll go work for a large company. Never can tell. It's always exciting.
So we have to end our show today, but the way I would like to end our conversation together is that one of the things I know about you is that I'm not sure you've ever been happier. I think you're having the best time of your life right now. And I think in big part, it has absolutely nothing to do with business and everything to do with the love of your life.
Goldie.
Oh, Goldie, we know you're going to listen. This time we didn't talk about sex positions. She's going to be much relieved.
My position on sex is favorable. Or as a guy told me once, look, Carlick, here's what ad is. You got an ad agency, and all you do is you do marketing for startups. So what that is missionary positioning, right? It's companies that are launching new things that didn't exist. So they're missionaries to the world, and you're positioning them. So you are Mr. Missionary Positioning.
Well, I know that you've moved on to some four-leg locks and all kinds of fabulous moves, but you have to listen to the last Ishy Mix to hear that. You can Google Dave Carlick on Webmaster Radio, and you can listen to that show.
Freddie Blassie and the figure four-leg lock and the inevitability of the final grip. It has a lot of application and implications. And Susan, you're right. There's a lot to be happy about, but I hit the jackpot with Goldie, and we are having more fun than is humanly possible.
And what is it you've been married before. You've stayed friends with your ex-wives. But what is it about this relationship that you think makes the difference? Why is this one the sticker?
Well, you know, I've gotten very lucky in my previous ones. It was great, and probably much to blame for me for them not you know, we're not still married, and I have my in hindsight could have done better. I certainly could have done better, but I noticed with having gone through those bumps and arrived with Terry that there are some things that you can change and some things you can't change, and the thing you can't change is how compatible are you.
Mm-hmm.
And I have found that you think that love conquers all, that opposites attract, that the passions that you share are enough, and that being the things that you don't have in common you'll overcome, or even worse, you think the person will change. And of course, the cliche goes, and it's fairly true, is that men marry women hoping they won't change, and women marry men hoping they do change, and of course the men don't change and the women do. And so a lot of the things that cause arguments and friction in a relationship are just because you just really see the world through different eyes and have different passions and want to spend your time in different ways. And in the end, that makes it harder. And whereas if you see the world through much the same eyes and you want to spend your time doing a lot of the same things and you enjoy the time together, it's a whole different starting point upon which to have a spiritual and sensual relationship. It doesn't hurt if your idea of what is sexual fun through and through is compatible, and that helps too. And it doesn't hurt if you have the same sense of humor. It doesn't hurt if you like the same food and like to go to the same places and like to keep the same hours and like the same people and like the same sports and like to do the same stuff. And if you have all those, then it's easy not to have an argument, right?
It is, absolutely. I'm unbelievably compatible with Tim.
Yep.
So I feel blessed that there's none of that static in the relationship. So for anybody who's listening, if you're in a relationship and there's not a lot of compatibility, you might want to rethink it.
Yeah, I think so. I think that one of the things, we live longer, and it may be that the idea that you're supposed to be married to the same person forever is only up to a point good for the kids that are being raised, because they always sense the underlying friction.
Right.
Maybe it's time to move on and move on as friends rather than not, and maybe get lucky and find somebody that you can be a soulmate with. I think that's a wonderful thing to be a soulmate with someone.
Absolutely, and I'm so glad you've found your soulmate.
Well,
you deserve it.
Well, yes, it's true, I do.
And so does Terry. So,
yeah, and not only that, but she is my guilty pleasure.
She is your guilty pleasure. I love that. How sweet is that? Well, and not so guilty.
Right.
We are out of time today. That went fast, didn't it?
It was.
Yeah, really fast. We have to try to keep it to a half an hour for our listeners because we want them to come back every week. So,
you can edit out the boring stuff.
Well, no, I don't think I will. But we do edit. So a couple of things I want to say before we go to our listeners. First of all, there will be transcripts of this whole show on personallifemedia.com. What was the other thing I wanted to tell you? Oh, yeah. If you want to download David Halberstam's books, one of my sponsors is Audible. And if you go to audiblepodcast.com/dishy, you can get a free audiobook when you sign up for the Audible Listeners Club. If you like podcasts, which you probably do if you're listening to this, the Audible Listeners Club is a really good way to get incremental information, great books, classics, and bestsellers, and business books, and all the David Halberstam you can listen to, including War in a Time of Peace, which was his number one bestseller about Bush, Clinton, and the generals. And that one's kind of interesting, too, I think. That sounds like a good read. So support my sponsor and support me by going to audiblepodcast.com/dishy for your free book. What's the other thing? Comments. If you want to send a comment about today's show, I've been getting some really nice ones. Thanks for commenting on my blog. It's at dishymix.com. And also just send an email to me, susan@personallifemedia.com, if you have any comments for David and or myself or any of our recent guests. So, David, thank you for being on the show today. I'm glad you came back, and I hope we can do it again sometime soon.
Thank you for the chance.
It is my pleasure. And thank you for listening to Dishy Mix this week. I'll look forward to hoping we connect next week. Have a great day.
Find more great shows like this on personallifemedia.com.